Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What effect do affirmative action programs have on minority enrollment at U.S. universities? Is it fair to consider them successful if large numbers of race preference students fail to graduate? My guest today applauds the goal of increasing the access of promising students to higher education, but he says the methods by which many top schools enroll minority students can result in a sort of institutional mismatch, which leaves some bright young people struggling to keep up with better prepared classmates while diverting attention from the shortcomings of the K-12 education system in public schools. Richard Sander is a law professor and economist at UCLA with a background as a community organizer and civil rights activist. His new book, co-authored by Stuart Taylor Jr., is called Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Your take on this issue is interesting because what it amounts to is a revelation of the unintended consequences of programs meant to expand access to education for minority students. Why have we tended to satisfy ourselves with enrollment numbers without paying so much attention to who actually leaves college with a degree?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's partly that a lot of the pressure and agitation that's existed around college diversity has focused very much on enrollment numbers, and the assumption I think has been that if we bring students into the system, then their outcomes will take care of themselves. There's also a tendency, I think, to downplay the importance of entering qualifications. The rhetoric in higher education is that every student has the same chance of success. So we tend to sort of dismiss things like SAT scores and high school grades as somewhat arbitrary measures. But applied to large numbers of people, they actually have pretty powerful predictive power.
Of course, SAT scores, aren't they largely predicted by family income? And that's something that, clearly you don't want to discriminate against people who don't have resources growing up.
Mm-hmm. That's true. They're correlated with family income, but they don't seem to be explained by family income. Hmm. In other words, American society is stratified in many ways, and students who have high family income certainly have a lot of advantages, but they also tend to just be very academically strong students, and they often have very strong outcomes in school, both in high school and in college. So when you take family income out of the equation, you still find just a very strong predictive pattern across higher or lower scores.
What kinds of adjustments to SAT scores, to grade point averages, are used by different universities to expand enrollment by historically underserved student populations or minority populations?
It seems that I think one of the issues with current affirmative action policies is that because it's possible for universities to simply set numerical targets for different racial groups, they often don't look enough at how to change the measures themselves. So affirmative action, when it started, was about increasing access and about rethinking the ways that we select students. But over time, it's sort of become a system of making sure that we have a racial balance in universities. And that, in a way, has let universities off the hook. I agree that things like SAT scores could be improved, and there are other kinds of measures we can look at and develop that would better reflect long-term life potential. But universities have sort of been able to sidestep that because they can achieve diversity, they can appear to be diverse by simply having different racial targets and applying very different SAT and high school grade standards to different groups.
And you make the point in the book that in many cases, this is far more than simply a tiebreaker being about race in a case of two equally qualified students.
Yeah, the size of a preference at a typical selective school amounts to a full point of GPA. In other words, A's in a white student's high school record are treated as equivalent to B's in a black student's high school record. Or, to put it in SAT terms, it's equivalent to about 300, 350 SAT points. So we're talking about quite large differences. And there's actually not that much evidence, I think, that small preferences have the sort of mismatch effects that we talk about in the book. But large preferences really do seem to.
So what happens when students who have been the beneficiaries of large race preferences or ethnicity preferences arrive on university campuses?
Well, it's easiest to see, I think, if you think about the sciences. Suppose you're an African-American high school senior who is very interested in going into chemistry or mechanical engineering. And by the way, this isn't well known, but blacks in American high schools actually have a stronger interest in science and engineering than whites as a group. They have very strong science aspirations. So if you get a large preference and you decide that's the best way to get a leg up in pursuing your science or engineering degree, you go to an elite school and you suddenly find yourself in a class where an awful lot of the students have stronger preparation than you do. They may have had AP classes or they may have had multiple years of preparation, and they probably have higher test scores. And the professor is not necessarily teaching towards you. Professors will tend to teach towards the middle of the class. And so we find again and again that students receiving preferences fall behind in their first semester of science or engineering work. And then things just get worse after that because those classes are highly sequential. So your second professor will assume that everyone has mastered the material in the first class. As a result, students who receive preferences are really, really likely to drop out of those majors and switch to something in the humanities and social sciences. Now, it may be that mismatch effects are operating in those areas, too. There's circumstantial evidence of that in a lot of places. But it's very easy to sort of measure this effect with science and engineering. So there are selective schools that admit students into these fields where only 3 or 4% are actually ending up getting a science or engineering degree.
I think it's important to point out here, as you do in the book, that there are students of color who get into elite universities entirely on their academic merits and without special preferences. Can you compare for us the performance ultimately on average of students who do and do not receive special race-based or ethnicity-based preference but are from the same ethnic group?
Sure. Yeah, and that is a really important point, Chris, because the you know, an alternate explanation for minorities underperforming in college is that there's a hostile racial environment or other factors, and undoubtedly those play some role. But a lot of the best research on this issue compares African Americans or Hispanics that have very similar backgrounds and very similar academic qualifications, but go to schools where they're experiencing different levels of mismatch. And we find that if you eliminate mismatch, you increase by about 80% the chance that someone is going to actually succeed in finishing a science or engineering degree. So these are large magnitudes. They're enough to affect the supply of minority scientists by 10 or 20,000 people each year. And another, I guess, important aspect of this is that some of the smallest preferences are actually those used by the most elite schools. If you go to Harvard or MIT, for example, those schools are able to pick from the very top of the distribution, and there are blacks and Hispanics who are at the very top and get into those schools. But those schools then also reach down. They start going down further into the pool of blacks and Hispanics to achieve their numerical targets. And that means that less elite schools, who are nonetheless selective, really have to start by going pretty far down into the black and Hispanic distribution to fill their numerical goals. And so in those second and third tier schools, you find particularly large disparities in academic preparation.
Tell us a little bit more about this term mismatch, which I think, you know, it's somewhat clear what it means, but what does it mean for a student to be properly matched at a particular university?
Well, there's certainly a lot we don't know, but it seems like optimal outcomes tend to result when students have academic preparation and credentials that are pretty close to the middle for the rest of their classmates. So you can have students who are undermatched, who have credentials that are lower than their classmates. You can also have students who are overmatched, who really have stronger preparation than all their classmates and could benefit from being in a more competitive environment. And this actually sometimes happens to African Americans and Hispanics as well. Frequently, those students end up especially if they're from moderate socioeconomic backgrounds, they end up going to community colleges, even if they did extremely well in high school. And those community colleges may not challenge them as much as they're capable of being challenged. Community college students often drop out for a variety of reasons before they get a bachelor's degree. So we can also improve minority outcomes by looking at cases of overmatching.
It's reasonable to pause here and talk about why Black and Latino students are any more likely to struggle than their white and Asian counterparts when they are mismatched or when they arrive at a university. Can you talk about the factors besides the color of their skin, which clearly makes no difference, that would account for this?
Yeah, the essential argument of mismatch is that what's driving these difficulties is relative preparation, and that, although you can cite minority statistics saying that GPAs at selective colleges are much lower for blacks and graduation rates are much lower, science and engineering persistence, as we've talked about, is much lower, but all those differences shrink dramatically when you control for the level of mismatch. And similarly, if you look at whites and Asians who go into schools with, say, an athletic preference or a legacy preference, legacy being where they have a relative who went to the school before them, those students have academic difficulty in the same way that other mismatched students do. So it really is primarily about mismatch, we think, and not about race. But there's one aspect of this that gets amplified for racial minorities, and that's the perception that on the campus they are collectively stigmatized by underperformance. So if you have a campus where, say, 80 or 90% of the blacks have received a substantial preference, and a lot of those students academically struggle, they notice what's going on, and they feel that other people notice what's going on, too, and there's a collective sense of stigma that reinforces this whole process and creates greater isolation on campus and other sorts of negative effects.
One concern that you've expressed is that creating, say, a freshman class that appears really racially diverse at a particular university tends to divert attention from the problems that exist within the K-12 education system. In other words, the reasons for which students might show up unprepared. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, and that's actually gotten worse over time. When preference programs started in the 70s, universities really invested a lot in outreach programs, and they sort of had a crisis of conscience and thought, up till now, we've really ignored a lot of the cross-section of America, and in particular racial minorities. So they reached out better to inner-city schools and southern schools and built bridges that hadn't been there before. And most of the students who were admitted through preference programs in the 70s were the first in their families to go to college. So you were really expanding opportunity pathways, I think. Over time, that's changed, and for a variety of reasons. I think partly because the Supreme Court has emphasized the role colleges can play in building diversity as opposed to trying to fix social ills. Colleges have tended to focus more just on racial numbers and not on opportunity per se. And as a result, the students that they admit through preference programs have become very affluent students. So in the 70s, about half, slightly more than half of all preference beneficiaries were from the bottom half of the socioeconomic spectrum, whereas in the 90s it was only about 8%. So there's really been a shift away from focusing on opportunity. And similarly, there's been a tendency of schools to back off from K-12 intervention.
Richard Sander is my guest. He's a law professor and economist at UCLA, and he is co-author of the new book, Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. We'll be back in a moment. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Sander. He is a law professor and economist at UCLA and co-author, along with Stuart Taylor, of the new book Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk here about dropouts for race preference students at elite schools. To the extent that those dropout rates are higher than for non-preferenced students, either students who are white or students who are of color, is it fair to ask whether the problem is that the social climates of those schools is somehow not welcoming to minority students?
That's really an important question for people to consider and examine. And when we do, I think it's plausible that it plays some role. But here's a good example of the dynamic. When University of California came under Prop 209 in 1998, it was no longer able to use racial preferences. So that led to fewer blacks and Hispanics being admitted to the most elite UC schools and more attending the less elite schools. One result of that, there was certainly a perception on the campuses that that Prop 209 had increased racial tension, and there were a lot of student protests over the effects of going to race-neutral programs. But the overall level of integration across the campuses actually increased. It turned out that the most elite schools, Berkeley and UCLA, were admitting a disproportionate number of blacks and Hispanics. So you actually create a more even racial distribution across the campuses after 209. And graduation rates went up, maybe possibly for some of these social effects, but largely because of less mismatch. So at some of the campuses, black graduation rates doubled for 4 years, and persistence rates in science went up sharply, and so on. So the overall outcomes were pretty dramatically positive.
How significant is the danger or the concern that if you were to eliminate all racial preferences, that a lot of elite schools in this country would be almost entirely populated by white students or Asian students or upper middle class students, and really be effectively closed to those who come from poorer backgrounds?
I think that's a real serious concern. And in our book, Stuart and I argue that we don't think racial preferences should be eliminated entirely. We really think that what's needed is both a spirit of moderation in the use of preferences and much greater transparency. Schools have tended not to talk about any of these issues because they're afraid of disturbing the racial peace. They're sometimes embarrassed by the outcomes that they help foster with their policies. So there's a real code of silence about what outcomes are. And we think that greater transparency can help to break that down and to get the conversation more focused on outcomes of students. And if there was greater transparency, we think that schools probably would reduce the very largest preferences they're using and just try experimenting with more moderate programs. More moderate preferences would actually lead to, as in the case of the UC schools, probably a more even distribution of blacks across selective schools. And if we supplemented that by paying more attention to socioeconomic status, we could actually increase diversity at schools. The big thing that's being really almost completely ignored by elite schools is this idea of socioeconomic diversity. As I mentioned, most of the beneficiaries of preferences now are upper middle class. So if we went back to that old tradition of trying to make affirmative action about opportunity, we could really increase the number of low and moderate income students on campuses of all races, and they could receive small preferences because there are a lot of them out there who are really being missed by the system now. So we could have a more moderate system of preferences and at the same time increase diversity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Jane in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Chris, another wonderful show, and I'm calling in again.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I am blind, and I was admitted to UC Berkeley in 1972 under affirmative action. And I think that my, besides being print impaired, I know that my math and science skills were pretty much nil. And I have to agree with Richard in terms of I had good math education and one-to-one assistance when I was in elementary school, but then in junior high and high school, that went away. And I remember sitting through math classes and algebra classes just not knowing what in the world was going on. And there wasn't really any help, you know, to assist me with that. And I was, when it came to taking geometry and beyond, it was just, don't even go there. So I know that, you know, affirmative action was employed for me, and I am so grateful for that. I was able to graduate from UC Berkeley and then get my master's degree in social work. And I've also been grateful as a social worker for the diversity that has come from affirmative action, which I know in my programs has been so important, especially in students teaching each other about their life experiences and what their racial backgrounds, their economic backgrounds, their disabilities, whatever. We've taught each other over the years, and I just really think that's essential. And so I just really disagree with this premise, because I've seen it work in my life and other people's lives. But on the other hand, I do agree with that the preparation really and our educational systems really does need to be better. And maybe, you know, instead of the timeline of first through 12 or, you know, sequential classes, if we could alter our education to be more self-paced.
Well, that's a lot that Jane put on the table there. But Richard, I'd like you to respond to that.
Well, let's think about how transparency can work in this whole dynamic. You know, if someone like Jane receives a preference and knows going in how her outcomes are likely to be affected by going to a particular school, you know, if she's told, well, students with your academic preparation and maybe even your disability have this outcome at Berkeley and this outcome at UT Austin and so on, she can make informed comparisons about which school might be a better match. And also the trade-off between matching per se and getting a more elite degree. And at the same time, the school, by providing transparency, has to take more ownership. They have to be more responsible for the people they admit. What we see so often, and as you mentioned earlier, Chris, is there's a lot of focus in university public relations about entry numbers and the existence of diversity, much less focus on results. And if those results are known, if they're made transparent, then the schools will start investing more, I think, in the students that they actually admit. They're going to be more responsible for making sure that those actually turn into success stories. And that really creates kind of a virtuous cycle where the incentives get properly aligned. And schools think twice both about how much they're creating mismatch and also what they need to do to address mismatch if it exists.
Well, to the extent that schools might have some mismatch, I mean, do they have an obligation to provide any extra instruction for students that they've brought in, knowing that those students may struggle given their preparation before college?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a really interesting example is to compare law schools and medical schools. So in law schools, and I teach in a law school, the bar exam is taken after you graduate. If you fail the bar, the school is not there to help you at all, and in fact, they probably would just as soon you disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a lot of students, I mean, most elite schools have bar passage rates for whites that are above 90%, but around 50% for African-Americans. And again, that gap is not because African-Americans can't succeed, but because they're experiencing mismatch. Whites who get admitted with large preferences seem to have the same problems. But the point is that the schools are not really taking responsibility for those low bar passage rates. They're certainly not telling people when they're admitted, and they're not helping them when they actually fail. If you compare that with medical schools use similar preferences to law schools, But your first national boards are taken after your second year of medical school, when you're about halfway through. And when students fail those exams, they go through rigorous academic support at the institution. Medical schools set up special programs for third-year students who fail their boards. And they basically are there to try to make sure that they do eventually graduate and pass the boards. So because, partly because of the timing of the tests and maybe some institutional design differences, you've got this radically different environment that really heals a lot of the problems in the medical school context, but aggravates them in the law school context.
How do students of color suffer when they have arrived at a university completely by their own merit, but they are assumed to be there because they were given special preferences?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most damaging aspects of preferences. And again, if we tried to reduce the size of preferences and get rid of the worst forms of mismatch, then I think those stereotypes would really be diminished. And one of the problems with those stereotypes is that they affect all students, regardless of whether they received a preference or not, if they belong to the category where that preference is perceived to operate. So I think it's very frustrating for all black students who go through higher education, regardless of whether they got a preference, that they're assumed to have benefited from one and to not be as academically able. And it's been shown that students who experience that stereotype tend to have worse academic performance. But we can't, you know, what some education researchers do is say, well, we just need to educate people out of their stereotypes. And that's not really an adequate solution either, because a lot of the stereotypes are based on genuine observation that many students receiving preferences really do academically struggle. So we've got to deal with it on both fronts. We've got to try to reduce the stereotyping, but we also have to reduce the rational grounds on which the stereotypes are based.
Well, going back to Jane's point from earlier, I mean, what about the argument that universities are just better places if the student body is quite diverse than if it is very similar?
Diversity is really important, but I think if you sort of looked at America today and looked at opportunities and viewpoints and so on, you'd probably agree that socioeconomic diversity is at least as important and maybe more important than racial diversity. I mean, economic inequality has increased in America over the last 30 years, often quite dramatically, whereas racial disparities have been generally declining. And about 70%, a low-income student who's otherwise identical to a high-income student has about a 70% lower chance of actually attending a four-year college. Those disparities don't exist anymore across racial lines. Certainly not between blacks and whites. So there's a good argument that the diversity we need is really socioeconomic diversity, and that's what has been almost completely neglected by schools of higher education. They do a pretty good job of achieving something close to racial proportionality, but the ratio of high-income to low-income students is about 25 to 1 in a typical selected school. So that's where we really need to be paying more attention if we really care about diversity. And to some extent, the sort of the racial gamesmanship has become a substitute for really focusing on the substance of diversity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Dallas. Hello, Dallas.
Hey, good afternoon, Chris. Thanks for all the good hard work you do. Can't believe you read this many books. first of all, thank you for having him on, because when I first heard about this book, I just totally dismissed it. And I guess what really attracted me to even call today was the fact that you're an economist and a lawyer, which gives me some confidence in your research. I'd like to hear a little bit about the research. I myself was a student in the 70s, was in an accelerated math program, everything coming out of elementary school, lived in an inner city, I'm black, and really didn't learn algebra. Got passed through because the class was noisy and so forth. When I got to college, I taught myself algebra, graduated Phi Beta Kappa, went to one of the best business schools in the country. So I have a couple of questions. One is understanding your research, and then secondly, to talk about the importance of collaboration, which is never measured in any of the admission exams, because collaboration is really what allowed me to learn in that environment and excel. I was a decent student, but I was a much better student in college and in graduate school.
And you're talking to Dallas about collaboration, like being able to work in a group with other students, that sort of thing.
Yes. In fact, McKinsey just released a study today talking about the importance of diversity and the impact that it has, in fact, in return on investment when companies are more diverse. And they're talking really about cross countries, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's get some answers to that. Really interesting questions. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't catch your name.
That was Dallas, from Dallas.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Dallas, where did you go to college?
Allegheny College. It's in Pennsylvania. It's a small liberal arts school.
Right. So, you know, I mean, my reaction would be that was probably a good match for you in terms of this mismatch stuff I'm talking about, because Allegheny would be a dramatic improvement over the high school you attended, but it wouldn't be an impossible reach. So you probably had teachers who really cared about your learning, and you probably had classmates that were in the same boat that you were in. Is that fair?
So he was well. Let me bring it back on.
No. Yes or no? I have to say, one of the most memorable experiences was being in a diversity session where one student who happened to be Caucasian, there were only, I mean, a class of 500, there were 11 people of color. And in this particular session, this person went on to say how she disliked people of color because it kept her boyfriend from coming in. I couldn't understand how five of us could keep him from getting acceptance. But,
So you experienced racism at the college, but did you feel that you were mismatched academically?
Now, academically, it was more a function of I'm going to win. It really wasn't. I don't think the support systems necessarily were there. I think the smaller class size might have been a point because I did develop relationships with most professors and actually took advantage of the opportunity to tutor and actually learn my subjects probably better than some others. But that was because I got a fellowship.
Okay, I'm going to put everybody on hold now. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Richard Sander. He is the author of the new book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. We'll come back in a moment and get some answers to Dallas's questions.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Sander. He is a law professor and economist at UCLA and co-author of the new book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. And Richard, you'll recall that before the break, we were speaking with Dallas, who was curious about your research methodology for the conclusions you make in this book, and also whether you had looked at the particular value or whether universities are taking account of the particular value of collaboration as a skill that can help one succeed at the university level.
Yeah, thanks. So the trick to doing mismatch research is to try to avoid what we call selection effect problems. That is to say, if you compare two students who are at different schools and suppose they have the same SAT score, they're going to be different in lots of other ways, and those other ways may make the student at the more elite school academically stronger. That might be why they got into the school in the first place. So you're trying to overcome that problem, and there are a couple ways of doing it. One is to look at students who got admitted to the same school but ended up attending different schools. So you know they went through the same kind of selection process and therefore are comfortable that way. And the other is to look at states like California that have suddenly changed over a 1 or 2 year period from having a strong preference regime to eliminating racial preferences. In both those cases, you have a better chance of actually comparing, you know, apples with apples. And that's the core of the research that I think shows strong mismatch effects. Most of this research has been done in the last 6 or 7 years, and I think it's really just in kind of the current debate over the Fisher case that it's started having a a real effect in public discussions.
Obviously, this is being discussed a great deal in the state of Texas. Can you talk about, if you could sort of whisper into the ears of the majority on this, what you think the ideal response to this lawsuit would be?
Well, Fisher's a funny lawsuit for examining affirmative action because the facts are in many cases idiosyncratic, and a lot of the facts aren't even established. It kind of went up to the Supreme Court without a very deep factual record. It certainly doesn't pose the mismatch issue in any kind of square way. Abigail Fisher is a disappointed white applicant, and if you wanted the court to look at mismatch issues, you'd want to have a black or Hispanic plaintiff saying that I got admitted, but maybe I shouldn't have been, or I should have been given better academic support or something like that. But I think it still creates an opportunity for the court, and the key person of the court, of course, is Justice Kennedy. He's likely to have a swing vote on this issue. It's a good opportunity for Kennedy to try to impose greater transparency on how universities do these practices. The existing precedent that the court's working with is from 2003, the Grutter decision that Justice O'Connor wrote. And that created a series of tests for how and when affirmative action could be used, when can racial preferences be used in particular. It was very vague in the way that it would actually be implemented. And at the oral argument last month, the court was really struggling with various concepts that Grutter had introduced. And it was very unclear what things like critical mass meant at Texas and how a compelling interest in diversity would actually be shown. So Kennedy could really do a service by trying to make these things more concrete and requiring universities to provide a lot more information about what they're doing. That would not only help them decide the substantive issues in Grutter, but it would also create this transparency that I'm talking about.
Why do you think there's a resistance to that transparency, given that universities are places full of academics who like to argue things, who like to get it out on the table? Why is this different?
I think because racial preferences are so sensitive. I'm at UCLA, and I discussed in my book some evidence that UCLA reintroduced racial preferences in 2007 because there was a lot of disgruntlement about the drop in black enrollment. And
Despite a legal proscription against it.
That's right. So it appears that my evidence suggests that UCLA started using illegal preferences again. And just bringing that issue up really set off a firestorm, and a lot of minority students organized and wrote letters and held rallies, basically saying that by raising this idea of preferences, one was questioning their academic ability, their right to be on campus, their contributions to campus. So a whole bunch of things kind of come out of the bag when you start talking about race in higher education. And that has led university officials, and you can see this by the reaction at UCLA, to just kind of clam up and not want to talk about it. So transparency is not going to come voluntarily from these schools. It's going to have to be imposed somehow from outside.
We have an email here from Erica who asks, do African-American colleges have a lot of mismatch?
No, African-American colleges essentially avoid it because they generally don't use racial preferences. And one of the kind of an anecdotal form of evidence about mismatch is the amazing success of many of those schools in producing, for example, minority scientists. So a huge proportion of blacks who receive MacArthur Fellowships, the so-called Genius Awards, went to historically black colleges as undergraduates. And historically black colleges produce about double the number of scientists and engineers that one would expect just based on their enrollment. So That's a pretty interesting model for other universities to look at, I think.
And do historically black colleges do a better job than other colleges overall at getting socioeconomic diversity?
I'm not sure. I would guess that they do a slightly better job. I haven't actually seen data on it.
Mm-hmm.
But since they're not just focused on trying to meet a particular racial target, and they probably are a little bit more focused on providing opportunity for the black community, I would guess they do a better job on socioeconomic status.
Let's go back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. We have Paul on the line in Richardson. Hi, Paul.
Hi. My question is has to do with the long-term effects of preferences. Because what I'm thinking about is you've got affirmative action has been around, or preferences have been around, you figure, for about 30 years or so. So has there been anything done, any research done on what happens with the children of the students who did get preferences? Do they not attempt to make sure that their students do better? Because it seems to me that there's a greater societal benefit to these preference programs that go to this whole issue of, it kind of went back to compensatory education and compensation, in some ways it's hovering back there, compensation for slavery or reparation for slavery, and a lot of things got pitched into it. But I'm wondering about the long-term effects of preferences in terms of student achievement.
So, Paul, you're talking about essentially creating families where down the line every generation assumes the next will attend university after that first generation. Am I getting that right?
Right. The next one attends, and then the achievement tends to improve over time. And so eventually it gets to a point where maybe you don't need preferences for the children, or even the grandchildren of the children who actually did get the preference.
What about that, Richard?
Well, it's a whole bunch of interrelated complex questions, actually. But here are a couple of thoughts about it. One is that it's absolutely true that we now have kind of a large upper middle class of African American coming through high school whose parents went to college and expect them to go to college. And that has certainly kind of increased the regularity of the college track for blacks and increasingly for Hispanics, too. But, you know, with preferences these days, it's not so much will you go to college as which college you'll go to. And one effect that seems to have occurred with the second generation is that a lot of second generation African Americans are not as kind of academically focused as one would expect given the education of their parents. One way mismatch might be affecting this is that a lot of their parents, if they receive preferences, got through college and went on to have good careers, but found college sort of a painful experience, didn't do that well academically, ended up in the bottom fifth of the class. And some scholars think that there's kind of a hesitancy about the intellectual path that's being passed on to the new generation of kind of the black upper middle class. Because you still see a large test score gap, and you see things like lower engagement with reading, more time spent on television, lower academic aspirations among a lot of those second-generation African-Americans. So it's possible, although it's still, I think, largely speculative at this point, that there's some kind of second-generation effect of mismatch.
How important is the goal, if you think it's important at all, that the faculty of a university be ethnically and racially diverse?
I think it's very important. But again, with all these things, one wants to balance the importance of diversity with the desire to avoid kind of a perception of hierarchy. In other words, we definitely want to have black and Hispanic professors, and we want to have other types of diversity as well. But we want to balance that and make sure that we're not using standards that are so different as to create kind of a second-class intellectual citizenship for minority faculty. Minority faculty don't want that either, and students don't want it. So it's always a tough line that I think universities need to walk.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Ash in Plano. Hi, Ash.
Hi, Richard. This is Ashok. Just want to comment about your overall summary.
Mm-hmm.
The deal is I teach physics at a community college, and I graduated from Purdue. And as you know, I'm a Indian, went to the school equal to Caltech at India, I went to Purdue, but I managed to send my daughter to, she's doing MBA at Dartmouth, and my son went to Stanford. Here is the deal. Part of the problem, you said community college students don't do well. Part of the problem is no matter what background they come from, if they have had a very good calculus course, I don't care this AP and all that thing, if they have had a very good calculus course and if possible differential equation, they tend to do well irrespective of their ethnic background.
So, Richard, does that speak to the issue of matching or not matching students appropriately?
Yeah, making sure that students entering a curriculum have kind of the same level of basic training seems to be very important.
So, I mean, universities don't have any direct impact on what happens to students and how students are prepared before they get to the university or before they're applying. But can you talk as a society about what we need to look at in terms of ensuring that any student who has the ambition to attend a good university, get a good education, finds that available to them?
Well, I think if universities, let me back up. You asked a while ago about sort of how universities can better engage with K-12, and there's a fellow named Richard Cullenberg in Washington who actually just did a big review of what happened nationwide in states that got rid of racial preferences. There are now, I think, 7 states that have banned them in various ways. In 6 of those 7 states, the universities launched substantial outreach programs to K-12, and they basically got re-engaged with the whole enterprise of trying to improve K-12 outcomes and also build better pipelines from those schools to their universities. So the interesting thing was that when you got rid of sort of the easy solution, racial preferences, schools started investing in the harder solutions of trying to improve K-12 outcomes and trying to make sure opportunities are there. I think that creating better scholarships for low SES students would follow if we pay more attention to socioeconomic diversity.
SES is socioeconomic status is what SES stands for, is that
correct?
Right,
yeah, okay. I'm sorry. So if we try to get more low- and moderate-income students in, we'll do a better job of actually providing financial support for those students. And within the K-12 context, some of the things that have been shown to be really important are improving the quality of teachers, trying to reward good teachers, making sure that students have kind of the cognitively best teachers that we can get in the classroom. Those things consistently show up as very powerful predictors of better performance.
Richard Sander is a law professor and economist at UCLA with a background as a community organizer and civil rights activist. His new book is co-authored by Stuart Taylor Jr. It's called Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Richard, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks, Chris, for the very thoughtful questions.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast, and Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions for the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.